we're like the second biggest AWS presence in the world right now. We maintain something called the master death file. If you're able to position security things such that it will help them save money in their ecosystem, they're much more likely to push their people in the direction of using it. And if you're able to help them move faster, it will push them towards it. So the more that we can leverage those like time and money drivers to encourage people to either like take a practice that we'll like put out a playbook for, or adopt some tooling that they don't have to worry about, and then just like democratize the data, like that has really been an effective move for us.
Hello, and welcome to the Modern Security Podcast. I'm here joined with Rob Wood, and today we're going to be getting into a ton of interesting topics, such as how do you scale the security of software at massive scale, as in one of the largest AWS presences in the world? How do you do that when you're working with people who are creating the software who don't even work for you? They're vendors, and like thousands of vendors, right? How do you manage that? How can you get things done effectively in government? Right? So incentivizing people properly. And we're going to dive into two specific big initiatives, building a centralized platform as a service and building a data ingestion pipeline and security data lake. So a little bit about me. My name is Clint Gibbler. I am the head of security research at SemGrip, a SAST, SCA, and now secret scanning company. I also run the TLDR Sec Security newsletter, which is a free way to keep up on the latest tools, blog posts, talks, and more right for free in your inbox every week. Rob, welcome. Do you mind sharing a bit about yourself?
Yeah, thank you, sir. And thank you for having me. So my name is Rob Wood. I am the Chief Information Security Officer at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS. And don't ask why it has one M and not two. It makes no sense. This is the government. So so CMS is the largest health payer in the US, which means basically like the insurance backbone of the healthcare system. We also set a lot of regulatory standards and such across health, across the healthcare system, hospitals, clinical environments and such. And so underneath me, there is I've got everything reporting up to me through like security operations and AppSec and policy development, compliance and system authorizations, national security stuff, supply chain, risk management. Like it's a pretty sprawling ecosystem of security stuff happening in our world here.
Nice. Yeah, that's quite the huge purview. Am I correct in understanding that within the government more broadly, CMS has like the most source code or the most spread of services of any organization within the US government?
So I don't know that we definitely have one of the biggest footprints in terms of overall technology. And like, if you look at our footprint as a combination of the density of applications and the size of the data sets that we're working on, and the number of people that we are serving and all of that, we have one of the largest. In terms of actual like number of services, I don't think, like, we definitely have way less than some of these more like, let's say like the Air Force, that's doing a ton of like, you know, they're doing like their weapon systems development, they're doing all their in-house kind of like operational optimization stuff. Like they've got a lot of like really small stuff, and then they've got some big stuff, but we have a lot of just big stuff. We have less big stuff, but it's very big stuff.
Cool. Yeah. That makes sense. And before we get into it, I noticed you're wearing a very cool t-shirt about the soft side of cyber. And I was wondering if you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 So, I should have mentioned this in my introduction to myself, but so, at the beginning of this year, 2023, a good friend of mine and I, we co-founded this thing called the Soft Side of Cyber. And so we were really focused on, like, well, we were inspired by this gap in kind of awareness and training and resources to support people in the non-technical side of doing cybersecurity work. So like I've worked with a bunch of like amazing people, and I've worked with a lot of people who are like, you know, that almost like typical or stereotypical, like abrasive, obnoxious security person. And like, if you're brilliant, but you can't communicate your ideas effectively or get people on your side, you are probably not going to be as like all that effective at the end of the day. And I've also, like earlier in my career, I was at Cigital doing consulting and such. And then I switched into running security at startups. And in those roles, you know, like nobody teaches you how to like write your first strategic plan or build a budget for the first time or hire somebody or fire somebody or, you know, any of that stuff. And so you're kind of like trial by fire in everything. And I have since taken on a bunch of like mentees and coached people and such in going through that same transition themselves. And it just, it blows my mind that we as a field neglect this part of the job so much. And so basically we wanted to like step in and try to like help fill some of that void. And so like the reason behind the logo, you think about like the yin and the yang of like technical, non-technical, and I mean, you could, colors don't mean anything, but you know, basically like two halves of the, or two sides of a coin to make a more like well-rounded, impactful security person.
Nice. Yeah. I like that a lot. I think, I totally agree with you. As an industry, we tend to focus on, improving like technical knowledge and technical, capabilities. But I think the more, I speak with different people, especially people who are further on in their career, who lead teams or teams of teams, and even individuals, say security engineers who need to get buy-in and work with say their engineering or product counterparts. I think ultimately, definitely you need the technical security background, but I think ultimately security roles in most organizations is ultimately kind of a influence role more than like a strictly technical role. So I love that. Yeah. So it's a blog and newsletter. Is that correct?
Yep. Blog, newsletter. We've endeavored, you know, we've tinkered around with some like, you know, video and podcast stuff. But honestly, because it's just us, we haven't had a chance to like lean into that as much. And, my video editing skills are not as, on lockdown as my cybersecurity background. So like, you know, those are not as pretty. If it wasn't for Canva, I'd be totally lost. And, that is so, yeah, but primarily blog and newsletter. And we've got, like a skills framework that we're building out. And hopefully we've got a bunch of things that we're like near complete on, like a bunch of sort of like resources to assist with certain things. So like critical thinking tools and things like that, like basically like knowledge products, if you will, that we're just going to like be putting out there to support the different skill areas.
Cool. I like that. Yeah. We'll definitely link to that in the show notes. So all right, let's get into it. So first let's dive into a bit more about the context of CMS so people can have a mental framework for like, okay, what are we dealing with here? One thing when we were chatting before this about how there is some differing incentives between different parts of the organization, which I think is cool to look into as well. And also like, how do you incentivize the behaviors you want? And then finally, we can talk about a couple of initiatives that you've been working on. So context, incentives, and then some initiatives. So cool. So yeah, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, there's a couple of very big apps, but yeah, could you tell us a little bit more about, yeah, what does the inside of a CMS look like? What are you supporting? Things like that.
Yeah. So like for reference, some of the like the big applications that we maintain, so like healthcare.gov is something that a lot of people are probably familiar with. Very large footprint. It's effectively like helping sign people up for our flagship programs, you know, like during open enrollment season and all of that stuff. we maintain something called the master death file, which is like the exactly what it sounds like. It is the like the file of everyone who has passed away. And there is a bunch of like kind of application logic around this thing of how people get on it, how people get off of it. If like somebody got accidentally put on it, because you could imagine that's like just a horrendous situation. If like what happens to your credit, there's all these like downstream impacts that could happen if, you know, a mistake happens there. And so the way that CMS is made up is like, we've got around somewhere between 6,000 and 10,000 like federal employees. The way that like CMS though is very contractor heavy. Like some federal organizations or just large organizations in general, they are very insourced. So like they employ the people that are doing the work, like whether it's software engineers or data scientists or product managers. In our case, you have these centers and components and offices, like the Center for Medicare, the Center for Medicaid, the Center for Program Integrity, which does all our like fraud analysis and stuff. And they have these mission purviews, like they're trying to do something, you know, whether it's bring an application to the world or satisfy some regulation from Congress or whatever it is. And the way that they end up doing that work is, you know, they get congressional appropriation and then they develop, like they write up contracts and then put out contracts into the world and bring in third parties to do this stuff. And that's really where things start to get complicated, is because you've got like, let's say within one like department, if you will, you might have 10, 20, 30 different contractors, and you've got prime contractors, which are the main ones that are like bidding on a job and they own the relationship. And then they might subcontract stuff out to one or 10 different other providers to like fill certain skill needs on the team. And the reason that that becomes challenging is like the whole business model of these kind of organizations is geared towards selling bodies. Like, you know, you get more money when you sell more, when you have more people build, because you're not selling. This is kind of like the difference between a professional services organization and the valuation that goes along with professional services, like a consulting firm versus a product company that has, you know, like higher, venture capital multiples in terms of valuation. Like selling SKUs and selling product is way more appealing. And so they're incentivized. There's these baked in incentives around having more people doing more work, which in the world of software, if you're trying to go through, you know, I hate the term, but like digital transformations that, you know, like the journey towards DevOps or continuous deployment, what have you, then you ideally don't want just more people like always there. You want to be able to, you know, automate yourself out of a job or replace certain tasks with, you know, scalable scripts and, you know, test harnesses and all that kind of stuff. And so there's a tension there of how does the government employee who might not understand this stuff deeply make those things happen in the contracts that they're overseeing? And how do they know when they're being bamboozled or when they're just being strung along, when, you know, like the cycles in government procurement are so long that, like, you know, you only have like your windows to really take corrective action are so, they're so small. And if you're like, you run a real risk, if you like rip something out, then you might be starting from scratch, which, like, you know, in theory is not a bad thing, but it makes a lot of people, like, there's a real sort of cultural risk aversion in government as a whole. And that can, it can really discourage people from like being too bullish with the contractors that they're working with. So it's a really nuanced tension that we have to balance as far as like building software properly and resiliently and like trying to build security into these things that are happening.
Yeah, that differing incentives is very interesting. So before, you mentioned a couple of things, but before diving into it in a bit more detail, quickly rephrasing what you said and zooming out. So it's like, okay, you've got CMS, it has, hundreds of applications it's supporting. Some are very big, very important to the US government. However, all of that development is largely happening by vendors, not in-house software developers who are federal employees. And even within one of those vendors, they may be subcontracting to many vendors as well. So there's like a matryoshka nesting doll of like complexity of who's owning the code as well as the security. And one thing you said that I thought was interesting is it's not just hey, I need this built. They write it and give it to you. They're also continuously maintaining it, fixing bugs. And it's, how you said professional services more than, I need this script or this application. Okay, cool. I'm going to own it now that it's built. It's like, no, they're still doing it. To your point, a lot of things that one would consider like good software engineering, like unit tests, taking actions to speed up the build process, integration tests, all these things like that. You do that to save time. However, when you're billing by the hour and by the seat, that is directly inverse. Like you want it to be like, well, I could write these unit tests, or I could pay someone to like click the buttons in order and it takes them an hour and they have to do it every day.
Or you're incentivized to just like, make it seem like you're making progress against those things. Cause I think some people or some organizations definitely are, but it doesn't change the fact that tension is still, it's still always there. And, it's like you read things like Nudge or, anything about like behavioral economics, and it kind of lays out for you, like you're going to end up doing what your incentive, like all systems kind of do what they're designed to do. And this is kind of how this system is set up. And like, we shouldn't really be surprised that we get the results that we get, or that it's hard to kind of wrestle with the system as it stands.
Yeah, totally. So to list maybe a couple of these complexities before diving into them further. So one, like people are, making money by the head and by the day. So there's not really an incentive to become more efficient. You also talked about, because there's all these different vendors, some of them may want to maintain ownership of their piece of it and not necessarily make it easy for a different vendor to like take over their work or to like, it's like, yes, you want to interoperate because that's probably in the contract, but like, you don't want to make it, it's sort of like that very senior developer who purposefully writes very like difficult to understand code and never writes comments because like he or she never wants to get fired. Like it's like that, but like a whole
documentation is the code, Clint.
Yeah, it's never out of date.
You're absolutely right.
So yeah, it's like you're getting paid by the hour. You're maybe making it hard so that you can't be replaced easily because there's all these different vendors. They may have different like CI/CD pipelines and security tooling, like all that stuff may be different. All that strikes me as like super hard. So can you tell me a little bit about how you, as the person who's like, hey, how do I ensure we're using money effectively? We are building like secure software that's ideally as secure as possible up front, but also like maintainable over time and things like that, because obviously that's a huge percentage of the software's life cycle. So yeah, given this very difficult situation and differing set of incentives, like how do you think about incentivizing the behavior that you want or good outcomes more broadly?
Yeah. So in many ways, like time and money speak volumes inside the government, and not necessarily to the like the contracting community, not to like disparage them, but to the like the budget owners. So let's say the person who is in charge of or signing off on things that are supporting a mission area. So like the owner of healthcare.gov or the owner of the Medicaid program, like those kind of people. And so if you're able to position security things such that it will help them save money in their ecosystem, they're much more likely to push their people in the direction of using it. And if you're able to help them move faster, it will it will push them towards it. And so in our world, like, the, you know, security is not normally known for helping things move faster, because you end up having to do work. And I think the reality in our ecosystem is, like, you're doing some kind of security or compliance work anyways. Like, you can't necessarily ignore all of it. You can do things poorly, but you can't ignore all of it, because all systems have to get what is referred to as an authority to operate, which is where myself and the CIO, we sign off on every system annually and say, like, this thing is authorized. It has a, what's referred to as an ATO. And in that ATO, you're accrediting a system against a set of controls, in our case, NIST 853. And so what we have really been trying to do is take modern security practices, like threat modeling or, like centrally managed software composition analysis tooling, or, you know, things like that, configuration settings that we can put in place at the, like, at our global AWS accounts or Azure accounts, that sort of layer, like, you know, security defaults, and do the mapping of those activities to security controls, such that when a team is engaging with them, they don't have to spend that time doing all that compliance work they would otherwise have to do. So, like, they're not spending money and they're not spending time. And so if we can use those two things to our advantage and get people to just embrace more of these activities, then our hypothesis is, like, what comes out on the other side will hopefully be better software, more resilient software. Because, you know, they're plugged into centralized tooling. They're actually, like, threat modeling their applications and changing things. They are, you know, updating their libraries, stuff like that. And so, the alternative, and some system teams do this, is, like, if they have enough of their own budget, they might just be like, yeah, we don't really want to interface with central IT. Like, y'all are annoying, and we don't want to work with you. And so, like, we're just going to like stand up our own IT environment, stand up our own security stack, and we're just going to kind of do our own thing over here. And that kind of, like, it creates, like, a firewall between us, and it's really hard to, like, influence in that situation. So the more that we can leverage those, like, time and money drivers to encourage people to either, like, take a practice that we'll, like, put out a playbook for, or adopt some tooling that they don't have to worry about, and then just, like, democratize the data, like, that has really been an effective move for us.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. So the argument for the development teams is, hey, you're going to have to do this security and compliance thing anyway. If you do these things that I prepared for you very nicely, you're just going to save all that time and money later. So, like, I'm trying to make your life easier.
Right. And for the contractors, like, so most of the way, like, most of the time when these things get priced out, the price is relatively fixed. Like, you've got time and materials, like, people spend, and then you've got something called OEM. And I don't know what in the world that acronym stands for, but it's basically, like, added expense that might be spent for, like, travel or tooling or whatever. And that's more, like, ad hoc spend, but that is, like, that's fixed. And so let's say some new requirement comes out that says, you know, thou must zero trust, or thou must, you know, do something about AppSec. And if the contract team does not have budget in that, like, OEM line item, such that they could just, like, buy their own tools and apply them in their context, then they're very incentivized to take advantage of something that they don't have to pay for, and or spend a lot of time setting up. And so that's really where, like, kind of leaning into some of the ways that the system works to our advantage is kind of how we're approaching it.
Yeah, I like that. Could you get into a bit more like tactical detail about some of these things you've built and how adoption has gone? And maybe you initially built one thing and then perhaps there was some difficulty in getting people to adopt it. And then you're like, oh, we need to change it like this. And like, I'm curious about sort of what you built and maybe that journey going from like the initial conception to building something that maybe is like actively, maybe enjoyable is too strong a word, but like useful and very low friction yeah. to more than one yeah. of the vendors has adopted it, for example.
Yeah. So like one of our more successful programs has been threat modeling. So like we engaged a contractor of our own and effectively brought in a small team to do, we kind of took the model from Jivan Singh over at Segment, yeah, now Twilio. And so like that democratized threat modeling approach, because I mean, like Avi Duglin talks about it, Jivan talks about it, and I like myself and both of those gentlemen, we've talked extensively about these things, and I love the approach. And so it's a combination of both like a lot of training material, like playbooks and templates and things like that to like give developers out in these parts of the organization the resources that they need to do threat modeling. But also we have a team and we are like facilitating threat model discussions, especially for teams that are like just getting into it, to sort of like dip their toe in the water and like, you know, kind of, it's almost like training wheels. Like, you know, we kind of get them going, then you kind of get them going and like, you know, hands off, see them go. And then they're like, and then they're cruising and then the training wheels come off. So that's been one of our more successful programs. And I think it's the way that we've engaged that's been the big driver for the success. Like there's nothing required. It's not a huge lift. It's like, it's pure value add. And it's on their terms. Something that has not gone super well. So like our Office of Information Technology has in the past like endeavored to stand up various like centralized tools. Yeah. You know, like some trend hits and then, you know, they want to like bring in a tool to like support the, you know, go enterprise and like support the agency doing a thing. And where this has ended up going horribly wrong is like static analysis is a good example of this. Like, and this happens like before my time. And then I helped shut it down when I joined. But the, like, basically stand up a tool, it's very rigid in its deployment model or its consumption model. So like, you're going to get it exactly this way with these rules and that's it. And this is just what you get. Do it or go away. And typically like when you offer a service like that kind of rubs people the wrong way. Like they want to feel special. They might have, you know, nuanced requirements and all of that stuff. So it either goes one of two ways. People look at it and they just say, yeah, I don't want that. And they just ignore it entirely. Or they try it and they get really frustrated with the way that the engagement ends up going. Because like, I mean, you know, I know you've done a lot of static analysis work in your career. Like, you know, typically you don't like start off with like throw the kitchen sink at an application in terms of rules, because it, you know, it's overwhelming. And you know, you get a bunch of stuff that you can't use. Like you start small, you get that right, you optimize, and you know, and you kind of grow from there. And that's like not how that's not how this went. And so it just ended up being an absolute disaster until it eventually got shut down on account of it just being a waste of money. So And there's like, and that's part of like designing a good enterprise service, I think, especially in this environment, like where you have a really diverse range of customers. You know, you don't have, everyone's not paying with the same color of money. It's like, you know, the range of technical ability is very, is quite large. Like there's a lot of things to think about, like as you're designing services or, you know, products. Like we rolled out Sneak as another thing, and that's like, that's gone really well. That, you know, we approach it very similar to threat modeling, where it's just, you know, we're paying for it. We have people there to like facilitate and support dev teams and like onboarding, understanding the results. We do trainings regularly, like that kind of stuff. Now we're like sucking all of that into our security data lake and like integrating it into the other like system authorization stuff that happens, like that they're going to need to do. But we're trying to do all that on the back end, so that way they don't have to worry about it. And so it's just like, again, just pure value. Just, you know, all you have to do is kind of author, like grant it to your, you know, GitHub, and our team will be there to help you out.
Nice. Yeah. That's interesting. To go back a little bit to maybe double click on what went wrong with the SaaS rollout. So, you know, like scanning for the whole kitchen sink all at once, obviously not optimal, but I'm curious, like, was it sort of like, hey, just give us all your source code, we'll scan all of it at once, and then we'll give you like a 300-page PDF? Or was it integrated into like pull request scanning, like into the sort of dev workflow, or like how tactically, how did it work?
No, it definitely was not integrated. It was very much just like submit code or submit build, and then you get everything scanned, and then you get either a report, or you can like log into some portal and view your results. And the problem really with it was like there was no contextualization of like, you know, maybe this application is not internet facing, maybe it's not using certain functionality, it has very specific user roles, and or like the attack surface is very like narrowly focused, or you know, or the people who are receiving the results have very little security background, and so they might need some kind of hand holding on understanding your results to actually do something with it. And so you know, if you don't do any of those things, or like, you know, kind of think through any of those things, they're just going to get the results and, you know, and just delete it and move on with their lives and say like, thanks for that scan. And nobody's going to be, you know, nobody's going to do anything about it. And that's just like, it just is pure waste.
Yeah. That makes sense. So it sounds like the contrast between this sort of SaaS and SE approach is like, the SaaS was not within the developer workflow, while the SE is, it's using, you know, GitHub or whatever they're already using, so they don't have to do a separate thing. Yep. Contextualizing results. So you're like, oh, like, is this important to you? It says hi, is it actually hi? Helping them understand like, what is the implication of this thing? And it sounds like some continuous training as well, and like continuous support versus providing a thing that they can self-service, but like, you're not really helping them. Does that sounds like maybe the core differences from what you've said that I've picked up?
Yep, I that's exactly right. And I think like, and I'll say some areas that I think we need even more improvement on, like the SCA side, is like we haven't done a great job of like leveraging EPSS, for example, for like vulnerability, like triage and such. So it's like, so we're still kind of getting like the out of the box vulnerability rankings, and you know, I sympathize with system teams, because like if you throw, you know, a bunch of Tenable findings at them, a bunch of Sneak findings at them, pen test findings, threat modeling insights, you know, AWS configuration findings, like, you know, it's hard to like all right, I've got six different sources of vulnerabilities, I've got highs in all of them. Like, you know, they're all using different vernacular, different risk labels, like, you know, like normalizing across all those things is definitely an area where we need to improve. And then like integrating things like the KEV, the EPSS, as far as like getting to the real important vulnerabilities first, and then we can kind of like deprioritize the rest of the stuff. And because I don't want anyone thinking that security needs to be like their number one job, and they have to like, it has to be above everything else. Cause I think that like, that's a bad mindset for security people to like evangelize in their organizations, because like, you know, the mission work has to be like above all else. Like, you know, in a business, it's like you're serving sales and growth teams, and, you know, in this, like in a nonprofit or a government setting, you're serving like whatever your mission thing is. And obviously like in a normal business, like, you know, the growth team is tied to whatever the org's mission is, but like security is always a supporting player. It's never number one.
Yeah. I like that service oriented mindset. How can we help other people achieve their objectives? For people who are maybe not familiar, could you just in a sentence or two talk about EPSS and like why people should care?
Yeah, so it is the exploit predictability scoring system, or prediction scoring system. and it is effectively a way of like arriving at a numeric value of the potential exploitability of a given vulnerability. And you think like some of the environmental variables that go into like CVSS, but you know, a little smarter and more useful, and I think more scalable. And so like some tool vendors are starting to like integrate this right into their platforms, where you just like, you'd get findings that just like, you know, they just come out and they're already scored, and you can like set thresholds for what you want to see and whatnot. And then KEV is it's a list put out by CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. It stands for known exploitable vulnerabilities. And it's basically like vulnerabilities based on their threat intelligence and like their understanding that they know are being exploited. So like, if you see those things in your environment, like, you know, that should raise your eyebrows a little bit more than, you know, that's something that is not on that list.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. So initially for CVEs or related things, it's like, cool, this is how serious we think it is. And then like beyond that, it's like, okay, well, is there like public exploit code for this thing? Cause there's like a big difference between, technically a skilled person could figure out how to write like an exploit for this thing versus like go to GitHub and just like spray the internet for it. And then like, even above that is like, exactly, oh, we've not just, is this known to be exploitable, but like, yeah, we've like seen threat actors actually doing it. So like, you should probably care. So makes a lot of sense.
Exactly. Yep.
Cool. So yeah, for this last part, I think we've already touched on some initiatives so far, but two that we talked about before this that I thought were particularly neat. So building out a centralized platform as a service, and then having sort of a data ingestion pipeline and security data lake. So yeah, let's dive into those a little bit. Do you want to start with the centralized platform?
Yeah. So one thing when I first started in the government, I was like, we had some extra money on account of like one big program being phased out. And we like made a bunch of cuts when I first joined, like getting, you know, basically like spring cleaning on stuff that wasn't working. And so I was really inspired by what the Air Force is doing with this program called Platform One. And it's effectively like centrally managed, Kubernetes containers oriented development environment to support continuous deployment in a government setting, as opposed to like getting ATO'd for every change that you make or going through these big heavy review processes. And so we ended up, we worked with with the folks at the Air Force, kind of sharing intel, all that. We still have an active collaboration with them on some like back end core infrastructure. So some of the vendors that were supporting them in that are key players in our own deployment. We ended up calling it the Batcave, or the Continuous Authorization Verification Engine, because every good government program needs an acronym. And, you know, Star Wars was a little getting a little overplayed in CMS. And so and I'm a big Batman fan, so this was my thing. And so effectively what we were trying to do is like take the CMS cloud program, and like we have, I think we're like the second biggest AWS presence in the world right now. It just in terms of like sheer size of, you know, like spend and all that stuff.
Not too shabby.
It's pretty like sickening when you think about like, you know, cost per minute sort of stuff that is happening, but like, you know, but it makes sense like given our scale. Basically we wanted to like take this the CMS cloud program and create like an abstraction around it. Create an abstraction around like deploying the resources that you need, have a container orchestration layer there, and then have pipelines built out in GitLab that supported like secret scanning and SAST and you know, like container hardening and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And effectively what we ended up doing was like mapping the cloud wrapper, the container orchestration, the service mesh, and the pipelines and all the stages within them to control areas like out of 853. And the goal was like, how can we maximize the number of controls that a system that builds on it, like builds a or migrates an existing application over to it, that they can just like inherit. And we are just shy of like 80% of the controls. And so like, you know, you get, and like sometime in some of these agency environments, like going through an ATO might take a year or 18 months. And it's like, so you think about like that amount of time, like lopped off your, you know, your process where you're just like, you're just getting all that benefit. And so that was like really what we were trying to do, with the Batcave. And it's been a huge investment. And I was also thinking about it, like, this is an opportunity for me to like infuse a lot of engineering talent into the cloud program and just like basically level up the whole program. Cause we had some engineers, but it was a lot of like operations kind of, like operations folks. And I think like just the investment alone of like building reusable tools and like changing the culture of this program that is like so vital to CMS, like that's been a really nice kind of side benefit of this whole thing.
Nice. Yeah. That's super cool. It's both providing reusable value for many teams, as well as giving the people building it an opportunity to level up and become experts in new areas. Yeah, I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. So you talked about a couple of things. So it's like maybe GitLab settings, some like maybe Terraform or other infrastructure as code, some like service mesh and like Kubernetes hardened configs and things like that. So like, if you can share, I'm curious just like operationally how other, like, let's say new vendor comes tomorrow and they're like, hey, we're going to start building a thing. Like, is this a, like a Git repo, a series of things they can just like fork and like start building from there? Or like, yeah, how, maybe this is too detailed to matter, but I'm just curious, like, how exactly it works.
That's all good. So basically we'd basically like onboard them into the platform, which like, you know, there'd be like extra pods and stuff that, you know, they get spun up. We're trying to do as many things in a multi-tenant capacity as possible from a, like a container orchestration Kubernetes standpoint. So like we'd get the resources there, you'd get your like your namespace, whatever. We'd stand up a set of pipelines for that application, stand up the repo for them. And if they like, depending on what they're building, we've got a couple of like sample kind of starter applications that they can like take and just start hacking on. You know, simple web app, simple API, simple data analytics tool. Like there's a lot of Drupal deployments everywhere. So like, you know, we have one of those. So like basically, come here, dude. So we got you get all these resources kind of like just provisioned and then you just get access to them and you can start like deploying. And the idea is like we want you to be able to deploy into your like production environment as fast as humanly possible, like inspired by that whole deploy on day one kind of Silicon Valley mantra. And because normally it's like you deploy maybe 6 to 9 months into a contract. Like you're not, developers are not moving quickly in the government, typically when they come in. And so the fast, like if we can shorten that cycle as much as humanly possible, like that's the goal. And so, so you get GitLab repo, and you can make more, obviously connect them to your pipelines, but you've got the pipelines, you've got GitLab repo, you've got the Kubernetes space, you've got an AWS, maybe an AWS account if you need it, with like resources and stuff like spun up there.
Cool. Yeah. That's nice. So someone asks and then you're like, cool, let me spin all this up for you. It's something, I guess, perhaps your team manages and owns, or I guess a like actual employees of CMS maybe like own these things, or?
Yep. So we are overseeing the whole thing, and there's a vendor that works with us that is like our builder, our like developers on the thing.
Cool. I like that. Very neat. Thanks for sharing. Okay. So,
Of course.
Second of the two initiatives. Could you say a little bit more about the data ingestion pipeline and security data lake you all have been working on?
Yeah. So security data is one of those things in the government world that is like, it's, if you've ever heard of Conway's Law, this whole concept of like you ship your roadmap, you ship your org structure. Like we fall into that hard. Like the government is very hierarchical, just across the board. And so you end up with all these like stovepipes of people and resources and money, but also of data. And so thinking about like all the data that goes into a proper security team, like you've got your telemetry and your logs, you've got maybe like vulnerability scan results, you've got, you know, training data, you've got compliance artifacts, you've got all this stuff. And that's only going to increase as there was a requirement in executive order that came out recently a couple years ago around like everything that we are building and or procuring should have an SBOM associated with it. Probably mostly for like compliance purposes at this point, but like, you know, you could envision like the government being more prepared for a log4j, log4shell style event. And so this whole security data lake effort, we've been building it out on Snowflake. And so like the idea being we are flattening our security organization structure through all the, like where all the data goes, and thinking about all of our teams from a producer and or a consumer perspective. So like you might, like pen testers are going to be producers of data. Like they're producing vulnerability data that goes into the data lake. The assessment teams are going to be both producers and consumers. They're consuming data to do the assessments, but then they're producing data from that assessment that goes back into it. And I read a book a couple of years ago now called Platform Revolutions. And the whole concept of the book was all about like the mechanics of process or of platforms. Like you know, the value derived on the whole of the platform is a function of how many interactions you have between like producers and consumers. And yeah, you know, it used examples like the Waze app. If like Waze could like provide this app, and like if nobody's using it or nobody's contributing to it, then like you don't get any of the added benefits. But like the more people that do that, the more people that see it, like the overall value of Waze ends up going up as account of that on account of that. And so like trying to take those same patterns and apply them to this program is really where we're at. And like we've had some things go really, really well and some things go like not so well as far as like adjacent projects. Like we had one all centered around like ingesting S-bombs and enriching them and then dumping them in a data lake. And that, like, that turned out to be a mess. And so we shut that down.
Yeah. Can you share a bit about what made it a mess or what made it not as useful as you had hoped?
Yeah, it was, I don't think that we staffed it appropriately from the get-go. And then internally in the team, there was a bunch of like, and this is what you get with, you know, contractor, like outsourced development teams and stuff. There's weirdness in terms of like, you know, there's infighting. And then, you know, at one point they had built something that just like did not scale at all. And so the lead on our side was like, you know, we've got to clean up some of this tech debt because this is going to like fall over the second we try to move it forward. So they did that and they opted to like rewrite it in Rust, and they had no Rust developers, except for like one. It was the senior developer effect that you mentioned earlier. And like, and it was just a total mess from a resourcing standpoint. And so it was like, I just, you know, we can't like continue to invest in this thing. So let's like reset and, you know, get another at bat in a little bit, because, you know, it's a problem we have to solve. I just don't want to throw good money after bad. Yeah,
that makes sense. So it sounds like it was more of a staffing and implementation challenge rather than like, oh, we had all the S-bombs, but like we didn't know what to do with them or we couldn't use them effectively.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because I feel like anecdotally, it does seem like there's this huge focus on S-bombs and like, oh, wow, like it's so amazing, we can do all these things. But I don't know if I've heard that many cases of organizations effectively leveraging S-bombs and like really getting a huge amount of value over it. It seems like, in theory, it seems very valuable, but I guess at least anecdotally, I'm sure some people are getting great value from it, but at least from what I've read from what's been discussed publicly, I don't think I've read anything that like, I was like, wow, this blew my mind. Like, it's so great that they did this. Not to say that you shouldn't, to be clear, but just like, I feel like maybe it's just early days. I don't know. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah. I think there is a lot of focus on like just being prepared for the next big thing in S-bombs. Like there's really no other way to systematically like prepare oneself for, you know, like the log for shell event at scale, like, you know, knowing if your SaaS providers are subject to it or, you know, that kind of thing. And so I feel like that's the big, like, it's preparing for the next big thing. Now, I agree with you wholeheartedly, though, like there's not that many good like operational use cases today that we're really getting. And so I mean, but like in the federal government's case, it's like, you know, we went through SolarWinds and then we went through Log4Shell like almost right after that. And like, those are two like really big, really nasty, like supply chain, issues. And it like, you know, we've got to be able to be ready for the next thing. Like, you know, cause we're in the business of the government and, you know, you don't want your government to like fall over and fail because, you know, bad things happen then.
Yeah. Ideally. Yeah. I prefer when it doesn't.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Along the Log4Shell or Log4j lines. Yeah. Something that we've built is sort of inspired by that, where You know, you have hundreds or thousands of repos, some new very high profile CVE comes out, and you want to know, like, okay, where do I have that? So we did build a thing that makes it very easy to basically search all of your dependencies for like specific versions in like a minute or something. It obviously, to your point, doesn't help with third-party services you use who may also be affected. Yeah, it's still early stages, but I think that's an interesting problem space that merits more work.
Yeah, totally.
So just like quickly going a little bit deeper into the security data lake thing, I'm curious, like, so you have all of this different types of data. So you talked about like pen test data or tool data and all these things. Now I'm curious, like, how you think about how to store all of it in a way that is, like, I guess ideally relatively straightforward to ingest, maybe allows some deduplication, and can also be leveraged by other systems. And again, like breaking down some data silos, you talked about different vendors having their own things like separated. Yeah, I don't know, that's kind of open-ended, but I feel like maybe thinking about the schema for that and trying to predict future use cases seems challenging to me. So I'm curious if you can share anything about how you all think about it.
Yeah, that's so we are all focused on, like, you know, how do we democratize and like open up the data? I feel like that's the whole Conway's Law effect with data that is really like so present, is like data is not accessible across team boundaries. And so we want to make sure that we want to make sure that it is to the extent that we can. And so, like, you know, there's probably a lot of use cases that we're not even thinking about yet. And we want to be able to, like, open up the ability to do those things.
Yeah. Do you, like, are you just encouraging different teams to be like, hey, please, like, put all your data here? Or do you define, like, the schema for them to try to make it easy for them? I'm curious if you have any, I'm just imagining people who are listening who are like, yeah, I've heard about this security data lake thing. I want to make it, like, operationalize it at my company. Like, what are the first three things I should do? Or who do I need to win over to make this happen?
So we're doing it all within the boundary of our security organization right now. And we onboard every, like, data source or team specifically. So, like, so we're not getting a bunch of unstructured shenanigans. Like, we want it very, like, structured and clean and like, classified and all that stuff, so we know what we have. And then that's a big thing for us. And then I mean, as far as like consumption use cases and stuff, like, you know, what people could do, the really it's like human-centered design, like brainstorming sessions, or, you know, we're just like, we do a lot of demo days. And so, like, we're showing people what we're building and try to, like, spark people's imaginations of, like, what they could do. And I mean, we're like a year and a half into this whole effort. And I mean, we've got some major things like moved over from a data producer standpoint and consumer standpoint. But I think we're really, like, just getting started on this front of, like, moving away from all our, like, legacy SIM infrastructure and, you know, like, just totally breaking down the silos. So I think it's probably a little too early to tell at the same time. But, like, I think the big advice I'd give is focus, like, don't try to rush and get too much stuff done too quickly. Like, really, like, onboard teams or data, you know, service by service, like, keep a data dictionary, like, that kind of stuff. So, you know, like, you know what's there, and how you might use it or who owns it, like, that kind of thing. So you have, like, nice clean pipelines or, like, points of aggregation, and, you know, yeah, you can troubleshoot accordingly, you know, if issues come up, all that jazz.
Makes a lot of sense to me. Well, Rob, thanks so much for your time. I was wondering, do you have any final, words of wisdom you'd like to share, advice you'd like to give, or just where people should follow up with you after.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm fairly active on LinkedIn. I've been crazy busy lately, so I'm a little quiet. I'm at Holy Cyber Batman there. And you can check out the Soft Side of Cyber site. I do a lot of my writing there. But I think that, like, if I'm going to leave anyone with some advice, it's like, I think the more you can do as a security leader to make security more of a, like a people aligned function, you know, whether you're working in AppSec or you're building a pen testing program or whatever, like, you know, focus on the people outcomes and the organization outcomes above all else. And like, let that inform the way that you set your metrics, the way that you prioritize, the way you train, the way you talk in meetings, like all that stuff. And I think that will help you move the needle like a lot more than you might anticipate.
I like that a lot. I think it's great advice. Well, if you're still listening, thank you so much for your time. Feel free to, as the kids say, like, subscribe, and I don't know, write a comment. But yeah, Rob, it's been a pleasure, my friend. Looking forward to talking again soon.
All right, sir. Thanks, Clint.